Hello, this is Susan Piper. Welcome to the Open Heart Project podcast. This week, our theme is mindful communication, and it's based on a talk I gave in New York City a few months ago. May it be of benefit.
So I'm totally fascinated by my own topic tonight. Our topic tonight is speech. And I've actually never given a talk about speech, so we're going to sort of figure it out together. So in our conversation about speech tonight, I want to just start by saying that we're going to be talking about speech as this kind of magical thing that is more than simply the words that you use to communicate. So in meditation practice, as we just experienced, there are three mindfulnesses: mindfulness of body, breath, and mind. And I mentioned that breath is sort of our continuous connection with the world. And sometimes it's called body, speech, and mind. Breath and speech are equated or considered to be the same or similar. And again, that's the spirit in which I want to talk about speech. It's this cycling of connectivity with the world, and it is quite magical when you stop and think about it, that I'm saying something that you're hearing. And actually, where is that thing? Well, we won't get too esoteric. So before we dive right in, I would like to ask for two volunteers to read something very short that I wrote down. And don't worry, it's not like I hate babies or anything like that. One and two. Okay, great. If you would both just come up here. So you're going to read the same exact thing. And why don't you go first, since you raised your hand first, if you don't mind. And it's just, this is something that someone else said, not me.
One morning, a series of seven visions entered my mind. As soon as I drew one image, another replaced it, until I had drawn a complex seven-stage journey of a wanderer discovering the spiritual path, having an introduction to his own true nature, embodying the truth, and re-entering society.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
One morning, a series of seven visions entered my mind. As soon as I drew one image, another replaced it until I had drawn a complex seven-stage journey of a wanderer discovering the spiritual path, having an introduction to his own true nature, embodying the truth, and re-entering society.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Just something I happened to be reading the other day, written by the painter Alex Gray about his work called, I can't remember what it's called, Seven Stages of the Path, I think. But anyway, I just, did it feel different to hear those two people? And one isn't better or worse. Did you understand different points with each reading? Different things came through each time. Different people came through. And so this was the start of my inquiry into right speech, what is called right speech, that two people can stand up in front of the same people and say the same exact words, and they will be heard differently and felt differently and understood differently. But nothing has changed. So that to me is very interesting. And I'm a writer and a teacher, so speech is my gig. So I'm interested in speech anyway. So if you've ever, there are sort of three ways of looking at right speech. I'm positing to you. There's billions of ways of looking at it. But in our lineage, we talk about something called the three jhana view. And I'll just explain very briefly what that is for anybody who doesn't know. But there are said to be sort of three main groupings of teachings of the Buddha Dharma. And the first is called the Hinayana, which means something like foundational vehicle. And those are like the first teachings of the Buddha. And the things that he initially said that were transcribed or remembered or continued to be taught. And the Hinayana teachings are very much about personal discipline and getting your own life kind of together. And it's things like, you know, don't steal and don't kill and, you know, just calm, pacify your situation and get your life in hand so you can practice the Dharma and become enlightened at some point. The second yana, called the Mahayana, is our teachings, and this is very overly, vastly simplified, but are the teachings on what happened to each of us when we basically get some order in our personal lives, some sense of discipline, some sense of we have a place to live, we have food to eat, and the basics are sort of in hand. Our hearts open to other people quite naturally. And the Mahayana teachings are about that opening, one could say. And they're the teachings on compassion and emptiness, which is the same thing, although I can't explain that because I don't understand it. But the teachings on compassion are connected to the Mahayana and heart-related teachings. And the third yana, called the Vajrayana, or indestructible vehicle, maha means greater, I don't think I said that, are the teachings, this is my explanation, so take it with a giant hunk of salt. What happens to us when we get our lives kind of pacified, the basics, and we know how to love, we can connect with others, then our lives become kind of magical because our path is revealed more clearly and we can just see more clearly. So when you look at the notion of right speech through the three yanas, I'll just tell you what I saw when I looked. So right speech, by the way, is very much connected to the Hinayana. It is one of the eight steps of the Eightfold Path that the Buddha taught as the path away from suffering. So they're really important steps. Like, if you follow these steps, you don't have to suffer anymore. So they're big. And the first one was right view. Everything starts with a view, seeing things clearly, understanding clearly. The second is right thinking. When you have the right view, your thoughts are correct. They also, they sort of cascade, the eight steps cascade into each other. The third is right speech. Right speech is a way out of suffering. And then there's right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right meditation. But we're going to focus on right speech. So the Hinayana view of right speech is it is, don't lie. That's actually not so easy. I'm sure no one here thinks of themselves as a liar, and you don't intend to lie, but if you just notice, like in the first 2 hours that you're awake tomorrow, if you lie, you're going to find that you're like lousy with lying. You're just riddled with lies. It's just, it's crazy. It's really hard not to lie. The second one is no divisive speech. You know, don't say things that separate people or pit people or institutions against each other. That's a big one. No abusive speech. And no idle speech. Like what you say should have some relevance, some import, and not be really gossipy or anything like that. So that's good, right? That's awesome. We could all start there, and if we did all four of those things, we would have world peace. I'm not exaggerating. So if you look at it then through a Mahayana lens, you might see that right speech is kind of an expression of connection. It's not just saying something, it's being heard. It's something not just that you say and someone else takes in, but actually seems to be something that happens between you and another person, literally in the space between you. And that's why two people can say the same thing and it just is different, because the space changes. They didn't change. I mean, the two people are different, but the words didn't change. You didn't change. The space changed. So I find that really interesting. And then if you look at it through from a Vajrayana perspective, well, I'm going to leave that till the end. So any questions so far? Does this make sense? Pretty much making sense? Okay. So then in my thinking, and I'm just going to be talking for a few more minutes, then I want to hear your thinking. I'm a Shambhala Buddhist. So I wanted to look at right speech through the lens of Shambhala teachings, which if you're familiar with them, you'll know exactly what I'm talking about. And if you're not, you will learn right now what they are. So in Shambhala, we talk about the four dignities. And they're four sort of mythical creatures that represent four different qualities. Tiger, lion, Garuda, which is like a mythical bird, and dragon. So from a Shambhala point of view, one could say that one quality of right speech is that there's a sense of knowing when to talk and when to shut up. And this is a vastly underrated skill. And not just in talking, but in music, in anything that involves sound, some sort of attunement to space and to quiet is crucial to skillful speech or musicianship. If there's just filling it, I mean, we've all been that person and we've all been talking to that person who just fills the space with words and you can't get in, it's very painful, actually, for both of you. So the first quality is knowing when to talk and when to not talk. This requires a very skillful and sophisticated kind of awareness. And if anybody teaches or plays music, you know exactly what I mean when I say a skillful kind of awareness. Timing is everything. The second quality that I would posit is that right speech includes listening. A long, long time ago, I had a boyfriend named Mark Kreiser, and he named a syndrome called the Kreiser syndrome, which is when you use the time that I'm talking to think of what you want to say next. And I've known many people who have suffered from the Kreiser syndrome, and I myself have suffered from it. But quite often, we use the time that someone else is talking to reinforce our position within our own minds. Like, do I really know what I'm talking about? Or they said that and it made me think of this, so I got to find a way to fit that in. And they're wrong and I got to figure out how to tell them. And in the meantime, you kind of are only partially hearing what they're saying. But a critical aspect of right speech is listening. Like really listening. Like letting go of what you have to say and listening. It's scary. But that's also a gesture of compassion. And the second dignity, lion, is connected with this quality of compassion. The third quality, connected with Garuda, and I would like to reinforce that I am making this shit up. So you must take it with a grain of salt and check it against your own understanding of anything. And if it, you know, if it shakes out, that's great. And if it doesn't, you don't, please forget I ever said any of these things. The third quality of right speech is, I think, the hardest. And the first two are pretty hard. And it is giving up your agenda, whether you're in conversation with one other person, being interviewed on CNN, making a podcast, teaching, you know, giving a lecture. When you give up hope and fear, like I hope it will be this, and I fear it will be that. So I have to pull towards me what I'm hoping for and really guard against what I fear. That's called giving up your agenda, in my mind. So when you talk to other people, I'm including writing in all of this too, by the way, and you're able to let go of your agenda, which is something that you constantly have to check from moment to moment because it re-arises all the time, something very genuine takes place. Something very magnetizing happens. And we've all known what it's like to listen to someone whose speech magnetizes or repels or does neither, but is just kind of dull. But I think that this is the magnetizing piece. When you speak without agenda, it has this very magical properties of magnetizing. And the fourth quality of right speech, in addition to knowing when to shut up and talk, listening, giving up your agenda, is telling the truth. But what I mean by telling the truth, using your speech to tell the truth, has nothing to do with anything moralistic, like, this is what's real and I'm telling it to you, or I verified this and it's a fact. Those are all good things. But what I mean by being truthful here is more like staying connected to the truth of reality and speaking from that place. Staying connected to the truth of what is. Because what is different than what we think. And when you talk from some sense of connection to that isness, and everybody has to figure out what that means, and I don't even know what it means, and I can't explain it, except sometimes I feel it. But when you talk from a connection to that, you're telling the truth, no matter what you're talking about. Does that make sense? So the last thing I want to say is the Vajrayana view of right speech, in my mind. The Vajrayana is also called Tantric Buddhism. The Tantric view is very profound. And we're in a Tantric house right now. Shambhala Buddhism is a Tibetan, connected to Tibetan Buddhism, which is connected to the Vajrayana. The Hinayana schools took root mostly in places like Southeast Asia. I mean, everywhere, but is mostly found these days in Southeast Asia. And the Mahayana schools in China and Japan, Zen is a Mahayana school. And the Vajrayana really seemed to only take root in Tibet and Bhutan. And so that's the language I'm attempting to speak. And their teachings are a lot about transmuting the suffering of everything into wisdom. And everything that you encounter can be transformed in that way. So it's kind of a magic, but not weird magic. It's called ordinary magic. And it's a particular way of looking at things and taking things in. So I've done a lot of talking tonight, yes, but in my life, including like being on television, on the Oprah show, and being on CNN lots of times, and giving a lot of talks and so forth. And so I've had a lot of experience to test this. And here is my conclusion about what makes magnetizing speech. And to me, it's a Vajrayana perspective. And it's only one thing that you have to do. In order for your speech to be magnetizing, by magnetizing, I mean people hear you. Because two people can say the same thing. And we both heard both Raphael and Kevin, but it could be that two people say the same thing and one person doesn't even get heard. And the other person, wow, oh, interesting, gets heard. So why? The difference is the magnetizing person has let go of fixed mind, which is what we practice in meditation. In our meditation practice, when thoughts arise to take us from our breath, we let go. We don't throw it away or chop it up, or we just let go and come back to breath. And that is the same thing as letting go of fixed mind. We let go into a kind of space. And when thoughts re-arise, we let them go again. And we're constantly re-identifying with space rather than content of the space. So when you can do that in a conversation with someone you love or someone you hate or in front of a classroom or whatever it might be, of course you don't want to just space out, but there's a quality of from moment to moment letting go, in order to tune into that space that we were talking about earlier, the space between you and me, between you and the world, between you and whomever. That's what I would say as one definition of letting go of fixed mind. So it's all about that letting go. And it's very scary. Because when most of us have something to say, especially in a public setting, or even something contentious in a private setting, we want to, this is what I have to say, I'm going to come in, I'm going to say it, I'm not going to get distracted. I think the three questions, I'm going to hear this, and I'm prepared to answer them, and that's all good. I'm not saying just show up and wing it. It's scary to just be right there. That's why I think speaking is so scary. And when they do those tests and they find that number one fear that people have is of public speaking, and number two is death. Would you rather give a talk or die? I think die. So anyway, just the last thing I want to leave you with is just, if you would, if you find it interesting, to contemplate this notion of letting go of fixed mind.